From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a Milwaukee researcher seeks new answers about what happens to a concussed brain.
Even after a player is able to perform tasks relatively normally and is no longer playing symptoms, their brain might still be healing in some way.
A recent book looks at the shady side of biotechnology. Plus, why nonprofits should think closely about the work of their governing board. And business is surprisingly good for a Milwaukee company that rehabs passenger rail cars.
I think it's probably bigger than people would realize only because it's kind of a hidden industry. The only time people pay attention to trains is when they're held up by a freight train.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Football season is underway, and that means the first touchdowns have been scored, the first goal line stands held, and the first injuries have sidelined players. And of all the injuries that happen on the football field, perhaps none is more feared these days than a head injury. Concussions sideline athletes in many sports and also affect people in situations like military battles and even car accidents. Recovery times tend to vary, in part because there is much that isn't known about a concussed mind. But a local researcher has some new answers. Dr. Tom Hamicky is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Zablocki VA Medical Center and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also author of a new study that looks at brain activity at different points following a concussion. Why is it so hard to determine when it's safe for someone with a concussion to go back to physical activity?
Because we don't have any mirror to the soul that gives us an index of when tissue is fully healed. And so we have to rely upon indirect methods of players telling us whether they feel normal. And we've used that a lot in our estimates of their recovery. But we would like something a bit more objective because some players are motivated to say they're fine when they're not. Other players might say they have symptoms that are not really related to the brain but are related to other injuries that they sustained while playing football. So there's a variety of reasons to search for better anchors for making decisions.
Well, and so if we take the subjective measures out of the picture, what are the objective measures that you're setting out to find that might represent the current shortcomings in what we know about what's happened to a person's brain who's sustained a concussion?
Well, a couple different sets of objective measures, some of which relate to measuring mental faculties, so measuring reaction time, how quickly can one make a decision, how quickly can one switch between things, how adequate is one's memory, per se. Other objective measures might be measures of balance and steadiness. We know is a domain of function that is easily upset with a brain concussion. And a third set of measures relates to imaging studies that might detect abnormalities either in the structure of the brain or function of the brain in some way that gets at the heart of what a concussion really is.
Well, and so this most recent study that you were author of looked at the brain in the time immediately after a concussion took place and 7 weeks out. What were the things that you were looking at in studying that?
Well, we were interested in trying to anchor this window of time after a concussion in which things are not functioning normally. The goal here was to try and determine what the window of vulnerability was for the brain. And we think that from our animal studies that if a player is injured while they're recovering from a previous concussion, that they don't recover as well, that second injury disrupts the recovery process, and because of that, they may not fully heal. So we are trying to target a variety of functions right after a concussion occurs to anchor it. So we had players from high school football programs in the region alert us when concussions occurred. We did some we arranged with athletic trainers to do measures on the sidelines and after the game. They sent them to us at the Medical College of Wisconsin for more detailed studies of their memory, their reaction time, their concentration, their balance. And then we also put them in an MR scanner and studied blood flow to different parts of the brain, both while they were resting as well as while they were doing tasks. And our goal was to look for any abnormalities that came about in those kinds of studies compared with their teammates that they were matched with.
And if I'm not mistaken, this was about 13 hours after the concussion took place?
The first study was typically done on Saturday morning following the Friday night game.
Well, and so what were the abnormalities that you found?
Well, on our behavioral tests, we found that their reaction time was much slower on the morning after the concussion. Their memory was weaker. They didn't retain information nearly as well. Their balance was off as well. All the standard things that you would expect in that acute window following a concussion. And on the scanning task, we found that while they were performing a task, there were regions of the brain that didn't get activated like the way they were activated in our control subjects. And so we looked at what those regions were and noted that they all fell in regions of the right hemisphere of the brain that we know are linked with attentional capacities.
Well, and so if these results were not unexpected, it seems that what you found 7 weeks later was a little more surprising?
A little bit, but not entirely. Certainly, the literature suggests that most people recover from these kinds of concussions within 7 to 10 days, at least on our standard measures of symptom checklists and cognitive testing and balance measures. They get back to their baseline. At 7 weeks after, in our studies, all of those things certainly were back at baseline. The concussed players looked exactly like the control players did. However, on the imaging studies, we found that the concussed players had activation patterns in their brain that were similar to the control subjects on day one after the injury. We think that that might have been a compensatory type of brain response in that the players improved enough to look like they would have looked like if they hadn't been concussed. Our control players actually had a slightly different profile of activation, one that probably reflected some familiarity with the tasks.
Well, is it necessarily a good thing to see this enhanced activity? I mean, and how long is that enhanced activity likely to last? Does this say more about the concussed players or more about the players who had not been concussed?
All good questions, and we don't have the answers just yet. In order to answer that question, we would need another imaging session later to see whether that enhanced activity was a sign of recovery or a sign of compensation. If we imaged a few weeks later and they looked exactly like the control subjects, then odds are they had probably recovered by 7 weeks after. But if we imaged later and they still showed a pattern that wasn't identical to the controls, then we can't blame that enhanced activity on practice effects in the controls. And we have to think about a brain that hadn't fully compensated yet, hadn't fully recovered. And indeed, there's a fair amount of literature that is growing now that suggests that even after a player is able to perform tasks relatively normally and is no longer playing symptoms, their brain might still be healing in some way. And that's that window of vulnerability that we're trying to anchor.
Well, and so is that where the practical implications for this research are likely to come in how we might treat concussion down the road?
Very much so, because I think that anchoring the ends of that window of vulnerability will serve establishing public policies about how to manage concussions very well.
Well, Dr. Tom Hammacke, thank you so much for helping us understand this research.
My pleasure.
Dr. Tom Hammacke is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral medicine at the Zablocki VA Medical Center and at the Medical College of Wisconsin. His study on the concussed brain at work appears in the September edition of the Journal of the International Neuropsychological Society. A Milwaukee academic looks at a side of biotechnology that concerns him and many others. We'll hear about his recent book when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The term biotechnology is relatively innocuous in and of itself. The Canadian government offers a pretty straightforward definition that writer Wilhelm Pieckhouse works with in his new book, Resistance is Fertile.
The application of science and technology to living organisms, as well as parts, products, and models thereof, to alter living or non-living materials for the production of knowledge, goods, and services.
But Pieckhouse, who teaches in the School of Information Studies at UW-Milwaukee, argues that there is a lot that is not innocuous about biotech. His book looks at how the Canadian government views the biotechnology industry and how the industry elicits resistance from many in the broader community. Pieckhouse first explained to Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom what some see as the benefits of the industry.
Well, there's a whole palette according to the government of Canada, and it ranges from new pharmaceuticals to environmental remediation, as well as new genetically engineered seeds that purportedly will increase yields while reducing the amount of pesticides. And of course, the major driving focus behind the thinking of the government in terms of championing biotechnology is as a motor for economic growth.
How might we come in contact with biotechnology in our daily lives?
The main way that consumers come into contact with genetically engineered foods would be through the processed foods that we eat. Corn, sugar beet production in the United States and Canada as well is heavily reliant on genetically engineered seed varieties. So the high fructose corn syrup that is used in processed foods, as well as a lot of the sugar that comes from sugar beets, is all produced from genetically engineered seeds. So that would be the main way that we're coming into contact. There are, to date at least, no direct food products that have been approved for human consumption or are in fact on the market as of yet, although genetically engineered salmon has long been in the process of achieving regulatory approval through the FDA, although it's still held up.
Are these genetically modified organisms actually successful in what they were hyped to accomplish, or are we getting more food or better food?
Well, the jury is certainly out, and of course it's going to depend on who you're listening to and who you're talking to. Major biotech companies, of course, Monsanto being the leading biotech company in the world, and of course here in the United States as well, would say that yes, it's been a great boon. But there's a lot of contrary evidence. A number of studies have now demonstrated that in fact the yield benefits have been hyped. They haven't produced significantly larger amounts than could have been produced using conventional varieties, and perhaps even more importantly, that pesticide use has actually increased quite substantially. Charles Benbrook, who's been tracking the numbers using FDA data, has demonstrated that between 1996 and 2011, around 400 million more pounds of pesticide have been actually applied to farmers' fields than would have been the case had conventional seeds been planted. The biggest reason for that is, in fact, that a number of weed species have evolved resistance to glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup pesticide that these crops have been genetically engineered to withstand. Nature has a good track record of finding alternate pathways to compensate for things that man tries to do to it. And so we're seeing an abundance of super weeds or glyphosate-resistant weeds cropping up, which of course is resulting in an increased amount of herbicide that needs to be sprayed over the crops.
So would you say that these genetically engineered plants pose any environmental or health risks for this reason?
Monsanto would have us believe that no, not at all, that in fact, you know, there have been no reported human health incidents. Unfortunately, it's a little bit difficult to actually prove that since we don't label food, so we have absolutely no way of tracking what's been happening. Other studies indicated that there are links between health problems, particularly around livers, kidney functions, reproductive functions in lab rats that have been tested over longer terms. So there are some indications, there are a number of studies, in terms of getting the knowledge out about these different crops and their health and their environmental impacts, is that it's very difficult to first for a lot of scientists to get the funding to do any work that might be critical. And oftentimes, as soon as these studies come out, the biotech industry has a very strong PR arm that is very quick to jump on board and start attacking these studies and the actual scientists carrying them out. In terms of environmental risks, as I mentioned, the evolution of glyphosate resistance among a number of weed species, as well as impacts on surrounding aquatic, bird, and mammal species. Then, of course, not only the genetically engineered seeds themselves, the glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's and other generic brands of Roundup Ready, also demonstrate carcinogenic properties for surrounding populations, particularly those people that are close to areas that are sprayed with these chemicals.
Would you say that corporate interests drive research motives?
Oh, very much so. Public research in plant breeding has decreased substantially over the last 50 or 60 years, and a number of scholars have been tracking that. And into that breach has really jumped corporate entities. And, of course, corporate entities are engaging in research, funding research with particular interests in mind, that is, developing products that they can then market. So they're not really interested in interrogating some of the perhaps more negative implications of their technologies. They're also not interested in researching seed varieties that aren't readily marketable, that is, things beyond the major cash crops here in the United States and, the developed world more broadly. And for that reason, we see that there are really only a handful of genetically engineered seeds that have been produced in the last 15 years or so. The problem, of course, with that is that a number of crops that would be relevant for developing countries aren't on the research agenda.
How do companies like Monsanto exploit the seed market?
Monsanto's been very successful in consolidating the seed market and bringing it under its control. Monsanto is clearly the international leader. And it's been able to attain that status by really buying up a number of independent seed companies over the last 15 years or so, which then gives Monsanto itself access to a lot of seed distribution, regional infrastructure, as well as access to the germplasm, that is, the different seeds in different regions of the country into which it can insert its genetic traits. And in fact, Monsanto has been the target of some antitrust investigations, although none of those really seem to be going anywhere. And then it's also alleged that Monsanto has put an incredible amount of pressure on the supply side in terms of seed sellers, the seed companies out in the different regions, by offering substantial rebates for its seeds, but making those rebates contingent upon these companies, these seed sellers, attaining a certain quota, that is, that all of their seed sales in corn, for example, or soybeans, has to be 70% of Monsanto seeds. In some cases, all of the rebates have been contingent upon meeting the sales in one particular seed market. So, for example, if they didn't meet the corn quota, the seed seller would lose the rebate for all the different Monsanto seeds it sells. So really some sort of heavy-fisted draconian measures that are forcing companies or forcing these seed sellers really to make sure that they're selling Monsanto seeds.
Farmers also aren't allowed to take the seeds from the harvest and then replant them.
No. I was talking about the seed sellers, but you raise an interesting point. There are onerous terms that farmers have to agree to when they actually purchase the seeds. And that's exactly one of them, is that, in fact, you can't reuse the seeds. You know, you're signing away that you won't reuse the seeds. You won't give the seeds to anyone else for unauthorized growing. That includes to researchers. You have to open up your books to Monsanto if it suspects that you as a farmer have engaged in illegal use of your seeds. You have to give Monsanto access to your fields. Monsanto spends somewhere around $10 million a year policing these contracts. So they have, you know, a little internal police force that investigates cases where farmers are suspected of using seeds illegally. They even have a 1-800 tip line that farmers can call if they suspect that their neighbors are using Monsanto seeds without a license, which, as one of my interview informants indicated, in Canada at least, it's really having an impact in some of the local communities where, you know, you start to wonder, Monsanto police are at my door. Who called on me? So it's really having an impact on the social fabric of some of these communities. Organic farmers here in the United States, they wanted to get a legal precedent put in place that Monsanto would never sue them if it found any of its genetically engineered seeds to be growing in their fields. Because another environmental problem that I didn't touch on earlier is this whole notion of genetic drift that genetically engineered seeds pop up in farmers' fields even if they haven't planted them. That is, maybe they fly off trucks or combines or other farm equipment, so that you end up as a farmer, you're planting a crop, either conventional or organic, and you find that you have some genetically engineered material in your field. So the fear among organic farmers is that, well, if Monsanto is suing farmers, then we run the very real risk of maybe someday Monsanto knocking on our door. Well, Monsanto put a little paragraph on its website promising not to sue organic farmers. Well, as you might imagine, organic farmers are saying, well, that's great, but I'm not sure that's a whole lot of legal protection for us. So they wanted to go to court to get something a little bit more permanent, a little bit more protective. The courts unfortunately dismissed it.
A number of organizations actively protest biotechnology. You cover their efforts in your book. What are they doing to change the game?
Well, it really is a David versus Goliath endeavor. There are a few groups that are organizing around biotech issues. I would argue that the three major ones in Canada are Greenpeace, the National Farmers Union, and CBAN, which is the acronym for the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network. CBAN is an umbrella group of 13, maybe 15 different organizations in Canada, and it's probably the most active because it really concentrates on ag biotech issues in Canada, whereas Greenpeace has a number of other issues, and the National Farmers Union is really similar to here in the United States. It's the union that takes care of family farming issues. So biotech is on its agenda, but it's not the main thing that it's focusing on. And really, in their struggles, what they're trying to do is open up the debate around genetically engineered seeds to broader public discussion, because right now in Canada there isn't much of a public discussion, certainly not from a regulatory perspective, where everything or almost everything is behind closed doors. There's no independent testing of any of the data that's provided by the companies in support of their applications for regulatory approval. So for the most part, the struggle is around getting out more information, getting out alternative information, providing alternative analyses of the issues around biotech, and more importantly, broadening the debate around agricultural biotechnology. It's a complicated science, first off, but it's also multifaceted science in that it touches on a number of political, economic, ecological, and social justice implications that they really want to interrogate. And that's part of their goal, is really expanding that debate, making people more aware of the issues that attach to genetically engineered seeds, and doing it in a way that makes it readily understandable to the lay public.
So opening up the knowledge commons, as you would
say.
Yeah,
exactly. Precisely, yes.
Do you feel that this biotechnological development can ever operate with society's best interest in mind?
As currently formulated, I would say no. And the simple reason is that it's in the control of companies that are driven by market imperatives, by accumulation imperatives. That is, they report to their shareholders and they are really only interested in turning a profit. And for that reason, a lot of the broader implications that I just touched on that these various organizations are trying to interrogate around genetically engineered seeds are just not on their agenda.
What inspired you to research this issue? Why did you feel it was important?
Well, I actually started doing research around genetic privacy. So the privacy of personal genetic information, medical information. And once I started to delve into that topic a little bit more, sort of peeling the onion, so to speak, I recognized that there are a lot more implications. And it was really just talking to people involved in biotechnology as a part of really ramping up that project that I was turned on to some of the aspects around ag biotech. And recognize that it really is such a multifaceted issue. That is, it touches on so many different aspects of our life that it really just caught my attention. And I thought, okay, this is something that I really want to research. As well as the fact that in the Canadian context, it wasn't something that has been to date particularly well researched. There are certainly people that have looked at ag biotech in Canada, but no one has done it from the perspective of the people opposed to it, or at least trying to challenge some of the aspects of genetically engineered seed. So I really just saw a gap in the research that I wanted to undertake.
Thank you so much for joining us on Lake Effect today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Wilhelm Pieckhaus teaches in the School of Information Studies at UW-Milwaukee, and his recent book is called Resistance is Fertile, published by the University of British Columbia Press. He spoke with Rachel Bloom. Keep listening. We'll find out how nonprofit boards of directors are changing in an era when the economics of nonprofits are evolving as well. This is Like Effect from WUWM. More of Like Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. There are nonprofit organizations in many sectors of life, from education to arts to, well, media. But what nonprofits have in common is how they're governed through a board of directors. But what makes some boards successful in guiding a nonprofit group while others just spin their wheels? A recent book on nonprofit boards offers advice in just this area. It's called You and Your Nonprofit Board. The book includes chapters by two Milwaukee nonprofit executives, Frank Martinelli and Pat Wisbinski, who joined us in the studio. It's edited by Terry Temkin, who was on the phone from Florida. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's so great to be here, Mitch.
Let me start with a big question about nonprofit board management, if you will. What's at stake from this issue? You know, why write this book? Why is it important for nonprofits to be taking kind of a big picture approach to the work of their boards? And I'll throw that to all three of you.
You know, one of the differences between for-profit corporations and nonprofits for many years, the traditional look at the sector, is that the board is the difference. Both have profit motive in that they want surplus funds if you're a nonprofit. But the way the board acts and oversees the organization has been typically different in the nonprofit sector. They've been more engaged in looking at many responsibilities besides the bottom line.
And it's a particular kind of board. It's a governing board. And the word governance, from the Greek word meaning to steer the ship, there's a lot at stake because the board, more than any other leadership entity in the nonprofit, is responsible for charting the future course.
Terry Temkin, what are your thoughts in terms of why this is so key?
I would like to indicate why it's so key now. I think Pat and Frank did a great job talking about why governance is important, why a book on governance is important. What differentiates this book and why this was so important now is that in the last few years, certainly since the economic downturn, we have realized in this sector that we need to do things differently. And you have many people who have sat on a lot of boards over many, many years who feel they understand governance, they know what to do, and unfortunately it hasn't been working very well. And we've really had to change course. And the reason why now and the reason why for this book is to help people see some of the new ways that they might think about doing things in order to be more successful so that we have stronger communities in the long run.
What hasn't been working so well? Why, you know, what have been the common missteps, either in the relationship between nonprofits themselves and their boards or just in the work of the boards themselves?
Certainly the whole issue of how do we fund an organization at a time like this, and that's not fully the board's responsibility to take that on as a sole responsibility, but boards have had to be very creative in how they approach it. It's looking at the size of the board, how the board can approach things. We've learned that one of probably the most important things is that governance isn't necessarily happening in the boardroom anymore. You've got funders who are dictating the direction an organization should go. They'll say, we'll be happy to give you money if you provide XYZ services that we know you haven't really been providing in the past, but this is what we want.
You know, Mitch, one of the things that I've seen over the years is that we have this concept of throw a group of people from disparate backgrounds together into this at the same board table and say, go govern. But it's not something that comes to us naturally. It is something that we have to learn how to do. How do we keep the mission of the organization in the front of us as we make a wide array of decisions about money, staffing, and vision of the organization?
I think another thing that really gets in the way of good governance for many organizations, for many nonprofit boards, is in this period of rapid, profound change, too many boards spend too much of their time looking backwards. And clearly, there's a stewardship responsibility. We have to ask questions about performance year to date, things of that nature. But increasingly, there is the realization, and it's reflected in the book in so many of the contributions, that a great board needs to spend more and more of its time in meetings and outside of meetings looking up and out at the horizon. What's happening? Which of those changes and trends are going to have the greatest impact on the people that we're presuming to serve, and then make decisions accordingly?
Well, and let me ask you about that notion, maybe all three of you, about that notion of training board members and recruiting the right ones. Can anybody know for certain who is likely to be a visionary until they make it to the board?
I think that there are personality traits that really move the group along. And those that we would say are always asking big picture questions are wonderful. But if we have a whole room full of big picture people, nobody's going to be writing the thank you notes or thinking about the details. So when you put a board together, you're really looking for a wide array of both personalities and professional skills and talents.
There's a statement that's gone around for a long time that when you've seen one board, you've seen one board. And you can have people who have sat on many different boards, and they have that experience. I am 100% behind Pat's answer. I think, though, that what is very helpful, and Frank alluded to it in his response, is that when you pull this group of very strategically selected people together, they still need to know about this organization. They still need to know about the culture of this organization. They still need to know how they can best represent this organization. And they need some training to do that. Nobody, as I think Pat said earlier, nobody's born knowing how to do this.
And there's no question that being on a board is an incredible opportunity to learn how to be a better, more effective leader. But so much is riding on what boards are responsible for that we have to do a certain amount of due diligence before someone comes onto the board. We have to, in a sense, move some of the process further upstream. We don't wait to see what we've gotten after we've gotten the invitation answered in the affirmative. We've got to spend time with prospective board members to really get a sense of them. What kind of a leader, what kind of a contribution will they make to the board? And is it in line with this notion of visionary, future-focused leadership?
Well, and I wonder if there's a certain amount of making sure that the board members understand their expectations before they take their position on the board.
Absolutely. We don't do that enough. Frankly, I see, and I know that Pat and Frank will agree, too often you have people who say, please, 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 we want you on this board. You're dynamic. You're bright. You're perfect for it. You won't have to do very much. I promise. You just have to show up at meetings once a month. And what that does is really set a very sad trajectory for the board and for the individual, because either this person who is so bright and dynamic, et cetera, is going to say, then why do you want me on the board? And they will run the other direction, or they'll come on and they'll believe you, and then they don't do anything. The setting of the expectations is critical.
Yeah, picking up on that, I think sometimes we just make the assumption that if we tell people what they're actually getting themselves into, they'll run for the door. I would argue that if they run for the door after we've told them what we really need, then let them run for the door. I think sometimes the opposite happens. We tell people the kind of challenge that we're offering them, and especially today and especially among young people, they want to hear that. They want to be part of a group that is really making a difference.
And active engagement is critical, not to just come to meetings and listen to somebody else's report about what they did last month, but what are the thorny problems we need to think about? What's the skill set that we need at this table in order to move us to the next level, whatever that might be? I think that most people would rather come and be active rather than just write a check, Because if you're just going to write a check, there's a different kind of board to sit on rather than the governing body.
Well, and Pat, you spoke about this notion that nothing will get done if you just have big picture thinkers on a board, say, or even like one type of personality on the board. Are nonprofits – you kind of write about this. The nonprofits in need of thinking about how these boards are subdivided, you know, or the organizational structure that exists within the board?
Well, I often, as an exercise when I'm working with the board, is to ask them to draw a picture of their corporate structure. How many appendages are there and how do they relate to each other? It's interesting that most times the end result is one or two boxes on a page, when in reality there are many different working groups that feed information to a board so that it can make decisions or the board discusses something that someone else can make a decision. But to put it in writing in a form of a picture to see how those relationships are accountable to each other is a very important exercise. There are many different models. We can use boxes and circles and triangles and stack them on each other as traditional boards have done. But in the book, I write about a Nautilus model where we kind of start in the center with the board and just keep adding chambers as tasks are needed around the center of the organization. And there's also what I call the farmhouse model, where it's just whenever we need something, we just put in a new outbuilding. So it doesn't really matter what model you use. What matters is that you are aware of the model. You can draw a picture of it and understand how all the appendages relate to each other.
Frank Martinelli, it seems unlikely that these are the kinds of changes that can occur overnight, especially given that organizations are unlikely to throw out an entire board and replace it with new members. What are the baby steps that that organizations ought to take as they re-envision what their boards can and should do?
Well, and before the first baby step is taken, we need to talk about leadership, that the kinds of things that we're alluding to, the kinds of changes that can make a good board a great board, it all requires leadership, leadership on the part of the board itself and leadership within the executive staff, the CEO, the executive director, working in partnership with board leadership. That willingness, that readiness to change is just absolutely essential. Beyond that, a lot of organizations begin with some kind of a snapshot of what currently exists, a board assessment, and there are several tools. A number of them are referenced in the book. So taking a snapshot of capacity within the board at this point in time, giving the board an opportunity to identify the short list of priorities. Rome wasn't built in a day and neither was a great board. What are the things that we're going to work on first? And I think in that selection of the short list of priorities, thinking about where's the leverage. We can't do everything at once, but where are the areas that if we really focused attention, if we succeeded in those two or three areas, that would have a spillover effect because it's high leverage.
Frank Martinelli, Pat Wyszynski, and Terry Temkin, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you, Mitch.
Thank you.
Terry Temkin is editor of the book, part of the In the Trenches series called You and Your Nonprofit Board. It includes chapters by Frank Martinelli, president of the Center for Public Skills Training in Milwaukee, and Pat Wyszynski, president of Management Cornerstones in Milwaukee. Our interview first aired in July. Have you ever taken one of those historic railroads, the old-fashioned cars sparkling like new? Turns out many of them are put back on track right here in Milwaukee, and we'll learn more about how that's done after a break on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Whether or not you're a rail fan, you might have noticed some private rail cars attached to the end of a conventional train or even sitting on the tracks at the intermodal station in Milwaukee. Or you might even have had the chance to ride a specialty or tourist railroad. Generally, these railroad cars have had a journey. They've served their purpose, often been put out to pasture, before being purchased for modern use. So it might surprise you to learn that many of the train cars are rehabbed right here in Milwaukee at a company called Avalon Rail. The company's shop is at the end of a road in West Allis in an old Allis Chalmers facility. June Garland is the president of Avalon Rail, and she gave Lake Effect's Dan Harmon a tour of the facility.
So on the end here, this is where Union Pacific, which is the mainline Class 1 railroad that pushes cars and pulls them out. So our track here fits about 5 before we start lifting them off, or in various stages. You know, the ones that are usually closest to the door are leaving first. These have just arrived last week, so they haven't been pulled off the rail yet. The one in the enclosure here will be leaving, you know, like I said, within a couple of weeks. It's very hard to get a sense of what this place feels like because the ceilings are so high. I mean, on any given day, I walk in and go, what the heck is this place? And I, you know, work around it all the time, but it's a little intimidating with the size of the space and the size of the machines that we work on. Now, this one, you can tell a little bit different. The logo on the other one with the gigantic lettering, they've now refined their lettering and logos just at one end, but the same paint scheme. And it is kind of impressive to see this client's cars all together because they have the swoop that kind of undulates while you see the cars go by. Okay. Kind of cool.
How on earth did this come to you? I mean, are you a rail buff, or did you just see a niche in the market, or something like that? I mean, and are you the one that started this? Did you buy it?
I got interested in the industry because a professor that I knew at Madison generally gets the credit for getting me involved here, and knew my low threshold for boredom. So I was introduced to the industry by him. And once I got involved, realized that he was very right. I learned something every day. So worked in the industry, in the passenger rail industry, for about 8 years before I decided that I thought I could do it a little bit better. So 13 years ago, started Avalon Rail, and never looked back, just moving forward.
You make it sound so nonchalant, but I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, that's a huge thing to do. Start a rail car rehab company, that's just touching the surface of what you do, but... And looking at the space, it's huge. So how did you go about getting started? Did you start somewhere smaller, or is this the space that you started in?
Well, finding a space in Milwaukee was a little bit challenging, I guess, for our particular needs. But we've been here for 13 years, so have never had another location, although we're looking at a possible satellite location to accommodate some of the growth we've experienced. But I guess, you know, in the beginning, it's kind of a good thing to be naive. And being kind of a driven person who grew up in a family business, you just look for ways of getting through it. And had I known everything that was going to happen back then that has happened now, maybe it would be different, but I have the luxury of not knowing all that. So it was easy, I guess, in some sense.
Can you just give our listeners an idea of what it is that you do here? I mean, I've driven here twice, and I've seen it's always passenger rail cars. So is that the bulk of what you do, is rehab? Redesign perhaps the interiors of rail cars?
Yes. The area of expertise that we've really found our niche to be in is rebuild. Although we're looking at outfitting new shells, that would be kind of a new area for us. So we'll deal with anything that's passenger rail related. Any car that does move people, did move people, we will deal with. So all the parts, turnkey, anything that's involved in that end of the industry.
How big is this market? I think when I emailed you, I described it as a niche market, which I realized later could just be really insulting because it might be much bigger than that. But would you consider it a niche market? And how big is this market? I mean, to most of us, passenger is just Amtrak and there's nothing else.
Well, I think you're doing well if you even know there's Amtrak. But I think, you know, the market's big enough, obviously. I think it's probably bigger than people would realize only because it's kind of a hidden industry. The only time people pay attention to trains is when they're held up by a freight train. So passenger rail is kind of hidden because they travel on freight trains for the most part. So freight lines, that is. So the industry spans quite a gamut of clients, though. So we've got private owners. We've got museum restoration kind of projects, and those can be either static display or rolling stock. And then we deal with a regular rolling stock that is commuter rail and excursion lines and the like. And there's a lot of business there. I think there's potential for even more, though, because the industry has been so saturated by people wanting new build when rebuild is really the same technology. And when people see what we can do with old cars and they look like new with all the new technologies that can go into the systems and they're a fraction of the cost, I think there's probably even room for more growth. So hopefully it's bigger
What is the design goal generally? Is it, do clients come with an exterior renovation and interior is an afterthought, or can it be the reverse, or is it the full package, I guess?
Gosh, there's no typical for anyone showing up with a particular scope here. So anything from an annual inspection, which, you know, involves some doing, so you can't just do it on a track side necessarily. Some you can. To full rebuilds, which is what we really prefer. It's a lot larger scope, more chance to really focus in on what a client's long-term goals are. But we'll do anything, you know, in between. I guess typical is hard. So, I mean, I guess I'd like to think that typical is a full rebuild. For us lately, that's what it is. But sometimes people come in, and in the difficulty in having a limited scope when you start is that once something really looks good, the adjacent parts then become an issue. So the aesthetic for people a lot of times is if you fix one area, if we have a lounge that we're rebuilding, now all of a sudden the kitchen and the bedrooms and everything else that's adjacent to that doesn't look as new and fresh, and that becomes the next part of the scope. So there is no typical.
Do you have designers on staff, or... I mean, I'm not sure if people bring cars in wanting them to be restored to their original historic status, or if people are open to doing something completely new. It's their rail car. They can do whatever they want. So maybe what's the divide there?
All right. Again, people are kind of all over the place with what they want. When it comes to a historic restoration, usually it's a pretty specific scope coming from the museum. And so they have a directive that the car either goes back to original, at least aesthetically. So I guess that's a good distinction to make for people, because aesthetics are one thing. Technique is another. And so if we hand paint everything, that clearly is more labor intensive and it will cost more than if we spray something the way we do now, which is a lot more efficient and cost effective. So it really is up to the client as far as what they want for an aesthetic in the end. You know, the mechanics, if something is rolling stock, is pretty clean cut. And then it's only dependent on where you need to travel. So if you are traveling on Amtrak, you have a lot of regulatory requirements that you have to fulfill. If you're not, then you need to tell me what you'd like.
Well, do clients come to you with plans and ideas, or an or there, plans or ideas, or, I mean, do you have designers on staff that will address these issues?
Well, I'm the designer on staff, so that's another hat that I wear here. But a lot of times clients do come in with their own designer. The learning curve is a little steep in this industry, so, you know, the concepts can be translated, but it's about how we arrive at the end goal. So a lot of times the attachment methods are going to be very different than someone is used to. There's a lot of movement with rail cars, so you've got to address all those things, as well as safety. So if you've got the general public that you're carrying, all those design considerations have to be mechanically sound for strength and everything else. So we're happy to work with other people that come in, but we can also provide that service and guidance.
I mean, when I first was reading about Avalon Rail, I saw the private rail car, and that is it's probably the most fun part, I would imagine, to just have a blank slate and a private owner who, so, and maybe even it happens, they say, well, dazzle me and design something for me. I don't know, does that happen, or is it always the case that they have something very specific in mind?
I don't find that a lot of private owners have a lot of leeway for me to play with. They're pretty strong people, and they know what they like. So there's usually a pretty specific directive there. I guess the place that I found a little more leeway is with Class 1 railroads, and when they look to have something that's impressive for their clients and their executives, they're not sure what they want, but they want it to look upscale. And so to translate that, you know, I'll give them some input, and we have good suggestions as far as what we can do with the car, and usually let us run with that.
How many people work here, and what's their skill level? I mean, I don't know why I was surprised to see it, but there's basically a machine shop, and there's painters, and there's people who have all kinds of special skills. So I guess break that down for us.
Yeah. Our work staff can vary from mid-teens to high 20s, maybe even low 30s as far as staff on the floor. Then we've got the management and office staff that support all that. So maybe we're, you know, at maximum, maybe around 40. I don't think we're there at the moment, but it depends on the client and the project. And as far as disciplines for what people do, we've got anything from fabricators, welders, carmen, to painters, interior cabinetry and finish work. From start to finish, you have to kind of cover your bases a little bit. So between the electrical work, plumbing, all the mechanical systems kind of stuff, we've got that covered. The things that we wouldn't handle in-house are some of the end finish products. Like, we won't install carpet. We won't do upholstery work. It's not regular enough for us, but we have very good suppliers and subcontractors that we work with.
You said you've been at this location for 13 years, which, of course, in the middle of that is a huge recession, and we're still in it, basically, maybe not technically. Is this an industry that it's such a niche market that it is sort of immune from at least the really sharp edges of a economic downturn, or is it just completely tied to it, like a lot of design fields?
It's one of the first questions I always had from bankers. As to what economic trends we could follow, we don't follow a lot of them. But I think through the recession, just like anybody else, we're working harder in different ways and wearing more hats than we'd ever did before. So we've accommodated what has needed to be there. We've been fortunate to be busy through it, though. So through the recession, we have kept people employed and gone through a little bit of growth. So we're very fortunate to say that. I think it's safe to say that we're busy. And not ashamed to say it, like when we were in the recession and worried about other people that were struggling. So it's a good place to be.
And as we were walking around, we were talking about the space, and we'll put some photos of the space because it's really amazing looking when you walk in. I don't know, I was kind of blown away by just the big the scale of the building and the height of the ceilings, and it's kind of what people would think of about when they hear factory. But you said it might be too small. So does that mean you're going to look for something bigger?
I think ideally we'd like to have a location downtown because it would make it easier for us to do maintenance from the trains right off of the depot area down by Amtrak. So we're looking into that. The volume of space here, I think, you know, is what's really overwhelming, in that our ceilings are 60 to 80 feet high. And we don't need all that height, but we happen to be in an old Alice Chalmers facility that just has it. So we have 60,000 square feet, and we need all that square footage and then some. But I'm not sure I need all the height. In fact, if my office were higher where it was a little warmer during the winter, I might enjoy that. So I think with a satellite location at some point, we'll probably look for a little more modest ceiling height.
Well, June Garland, congratulations on the successful business right here in Milwaukee. Some people don't even know it's here, so I think it's really interesting. So thank you for coming on Lake Effect.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
June Garland is owner and president of Milwaukee's Avalon Rail, a company that rehabs old train cars for modern use. She spoke with Dan Harmon from the company's facility in West Allis. You can find pictures of the facility and more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That is Monday's edition of the program. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today. I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is coming your way next. It's 11 o'clock.